This is a serial entrepreneur.
I know people with money. I'm also really good at asking men for money.
Are you?
Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a career. How do you build something that someone's going to pay for? You have to create something that survives you. Right, you've got, you know, that my mantra was always, what is making money whilst I'm asleep? Everyone in my businesses knows that I want a cash flow report overnight every day.
She's built three companies and gone on to sell every one of them. And she's now on her fourth.
In the US, a digital platform went like an absolute rocket ship around the time of Trump won, where feminism was probably a different conversation, loads of private equity money attached to that. When COVID happened, our revenue was zero overnight. At the time when I started pitching for venture capital funding, which I did get in 2010-11, I was told by so many investors, nobody would ever stay in a stranger's home. So if you think about how we travel now, and you know, it just wasn't what anybody did in 2010. For the last probably decade, I've only put my personal money into backing women. I think it's really important that I put my money where my mouth is. Why do I back these women? Because I think that they can deliver me at least a 10x return. Otherwise, forget it. I'm not even having the conversation.
It is a classic example of build, sell, and repeat.
Let's start with Love Home Swap.
Yes.
That's the big ticket item. Now I read you sold that for 53 million.
I did, yeah.
Did you know?
I did.
53 million is a big number. There are other bigger exits. But at the end of the day, all that mattered is as founder, I'd hung on to the equity. And I think we don't understand that well enough. Women founders definitely don't understand that well enough.
We are delighted today to have Debbie Wasko on, who is probably one of the biggest serial entrepreneurs we've had on the show. Welcome to Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Thank you for having me.
Debbie, how have you done that three times over?
Yeah, which is the first question.
Yes. What's the little pink ticket? What is it that you have that the rest of us don't?
I think a lot of it is to do with figuring out how it works. And I think starting quite young. So I set up my first business at 25, and there's nothing like doing therapy and writing a book to make you wonder as you age why you do the things you do. And I've done both of those things in the last few years. I think for me, one of the red threads through my life is I always say I'm the latest in a long line of proudly difficult women. And the women in my life have been strong role models. My grandmother, who died at 96, took over her husband's business after he had died. And my formative memories are of the women in my life working and having a lot of children. In my grandmother's case, she never really learned how to reverse a car. And I'm a famously awful driver, so that's clearly genetic. But, you know, she drove around her van dropping money off at the bank. So I think when I think about my why and my how, I'd only ever seen women do that stuff. It didn't ever occur to me in my childhood that women didn't run the world, because they ran my family. And they were very, very clear in a very un-British way that it was okay to talk about money around the dinner table. You know, I'm from a line of immigrants to the UK where everybody ran their own business and the businesses were super humble. So they would never have said they were entrepreneurs, because that's a very fancy word, but they were business owners. I didn't know anybody that went to work to do a job for somebody else. That just didn't happen in my extended family.
What country are they from?
Poland on one side, wow, and from Odessa on the other side. And they arrived here around the turn of the 20th century. And I think also it shows how grit and determination are everything. My father was the first person in the family to go to university. In immigrant families, I think education is prized very highly, but so is just sheer graft. And I saw a lot of people grafting. And so I always knew that I would do my own thing. And I'm a nerd. So I had a sort of very classic academic education. I went to Oxford. I studied philosophy, which qualifies you for precisely nothing. But I can talk a lot about Descartes' Cartesian circle and lots of other useless things. But I went into management consultancy straight after graduating.
How
but
did
I,
you pay
I never
for
wanted to do that. I always worked. I've always worked. And everybody in my family's always worked. And I think you're either a shop assistant or a bartender. And I was a shop assistant because I like clothes. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of good at that throughout. But I think getting going at 25, to me, starting a business at that age is fantastic because you've absolutely nothing to lose. You know, like what's the worst that can happen? And that's kind of my life mantra, which sometimes gets me into trouble. Like what's the worst that can happen? When you're 25, nothing. When you're 45 and you're going for the first time, you have a lot to lose. And everything that I know about business and everything that I know about packaging a business to sell it, which is my one trick. That's the thing I know how to do. I learned in that first business.
Talk us through then, what's the secret about packaging a business? So your first business, was that a PR?
It was an agency, a PR and marketing agency called Mantra. Yeah. And this was in .com one. So I think bit now when I think about my kids, it was 1999, 2000. I think about my kids now. And there's a lot which we would only ask young people to do in the world of employment, kind of part AI at the moment. But if you want your TikTok handling, or you're not going to ask a 45-year-old to do that, right? So it's sort of a prize to be young. And I think that was probably the first time it felt like that, if you can remember, 99, 2000. Being 25 was seen as a good thing if you were in that industry.
In Silicon Valley.
Okay, so you remember.
Yeah.
So there was a moment where actually that was a competitive advantage, and I took advantage of that with only 4 years of work experience and frankly not knowing a lot about a lot, but having a phone and some chutzpah and building a client services business is a fantastic first business, because you learn the basic rules of business, which is you're always two client wins away from greatness and you're two client losses away from disaster.
Amazing.
Right. And the same can be said for any of the businesses that we've 100%. Probably run, right? So you learn everything about the shit that matters, which is cash flow. I still obsessively in my businesses check the bank account every day. You know, everyone in my businesses knows that I want a cash flow report overnight every day. And I think that's a lot of the reason for my successes. I sweat the small stuff, no matter how big the business and no matter how grand it becomes. That first experience, and maybe my kind of family's formative experience about like, what can you buy something for and what can you sell it for?
Are you extravagant? Still there. You don't strike me as an extravagant.
Not really. I mean, I like stuff, but I think I'm money motivated because for me, money is about winning. And I like to
power,
win,
yeah.
Right? It's about winning. And it's also about economic independence as a woman. And actually, that was a really strong message through my upbringing, that women needed to have their own money. You know, there's a lot of divorce running through my family. And there was a real sense that you needed to be able to have money in a bank account that meant that you could control your own future and your own freedom. I felt that very strongly even as a child.
You went on to sell that?
I did. I sold it in 2007.
It's a big achievement. To sell a PR company,
yes,
because that's not easy, because you're really, because you are the main person, and I've had so many PRs over the years.
Yes, I bet.
So how did you manage to sell that?
So I think two things that were formative at that time. I very quickly cottoned onto the fact that you needed to be selling product as well as service. So you needed something that would survive the founder departing, which is generally what happens, and indeed happened in Mantra's case within a year. To rewind, at the time we built up, and this sounds sort of ridiculous now, but this was a long time ago, a product that would enable you to monitor opinion online for your product or business. So we had something in alongside service that made it special. And I think that's a theme throughout to answer in a very long-winded way your question about how do you do it? Like, how do you build something that someone's going to pay for? You have to create something that survives you, right? You've got, you know, that my mantra was always, what is making money whilst I'm asleep? Because if you're only selling time for money, it's very, very hard to ascribe a value to that. So even when I had agency, I was conscious of products as well as service. I think you need to build something different. Like, you've always got to ask yourself, why does someone give a shit? Like, whatever it is you're building. And in agency world, it has to be distinctive. It has to have a product. It has to have a focus. Far better to be specialist than generalist. So we sold because we were the agency that understood the internet, that had a product and built into what we did, where the founders were still quite young. I was 31, I think, two maybe when I sold. And that made us distinctive, and it made us an asset that somebody would want to buy. And it informed everything I've known in my career to follow, because this question of why should anyone care is very, very fundamental to me. And when you're thinking about building something, you have to think about the exit before you even start. Because if you don't think about it, it's never going to happen.
It's really interesting. Sorry, Roz, just for a second, because obviously we've had a lot of entrepreneurs on this show, and some say they don't even think about the exit. It's different strategies for different people. Because I always ask that question, do you think about the exit before just when you're setting up the business?
There are many different flavours of entrepreneur. You know, I have amazingly smart, successful, brilliant friends who have run the same business for 25 years. I have a short attention span for anything. I don't really have more than 5 or 6 years of anything in me. And I think also if you're a direct-to-consumer founder, as I have been with Love Home Swap and Albright and Better Menopause and for everything we're going to talk about, you are your own lowest cost of sales. Right. So at the end of the day, if you stood talking about how you came up with the idea of Beloved Homeswap, watching the film The Holiday on a Plane 3,000 times with Cameron Diaz and Kate Winslet playing behind your head, believe me, you start to feel like a stand-up comedian in need of some new material, right? You're so sick of the sound of your own voice that the thought of doing that for 25 years for me is unthinkable. Therefore, when you start, I don't even start unless I'm very, very clear what I'm building and for
whom.
Do you know what I love about you as well? That we had a founder on and they've been told by their chairman that you can only get lucky once. You have got not lucky. You have created your environment and your luck in multiple different industries. What do you think is the formula for that? Because I'm a huge believer in in you can do anything in any industry. But what is it about your approach that has been so successful? So let's start with Love Home Swap.
Yes.
That's the big ticket item. Now I read you sold that for 53 million.
I did, yeah.
Did you tell
HMRC? I'm not going to lie. I thought, I'm going to throw that out there. And she's going to say, well, I might have done that.
No, I did.
Thank you. You're the only honest
in the public domain. But okay, so I'm going to try and bridge between those two questions a little bit, because I want to get to why it's really important that women talk about money. So maybe let's put a pin in that. But just to answer your why, your how. I don't believe in luck. Right? I just don't. No. I think you try hard enough that at some point luck happens. I just don't believe in that. And I believe in 3 G's, right? And they run in this order. And this is how I focus on how I spend my time and what I look for when I invest, because I do invest in other businesses. And the first G is graft. I'm a northerner, right? You just have to work really hard. And I don't want to gild the lily about entrepreneurship. It is incredibly hard work,
it's incredibly hard work,
right? You know, you have to be prepared to outwork everybody. I get really nervous with conversations about work-life balance and I haven't had a lot of it. You know, I work every weekend.
Do you still do that, Debbie?
Yeah, I do work at the weekends.
But you don't need to anymore.
But I want everything I do, I care about, otherwise I wouldn't do it. And I'm very, very driven to succeed. And I'm driven by the dark and the light, right? The light is the sunlit up plans of the thing that I'm creating. So I'm incredibly optimistic, all entrepreneurs are. I'm not just glass half full, it's on the table, right? We all have that uncommon maze, it's going to rocket ship.
Go big or go home.
But I'm also very, very motivated by the shade. And the shade is the power of fuck you, right? Oh, yeah. So I have a shit list of people that I'm going to show them that I can do it. And you don't get to be a successful 52-year-old woman who is financially successful if you can't fight. Yeah. Exactly. And I, you know, I famously work out every day. I box.
Oh, I box too. I used to do that.
And I have a face on the end of my fist every single day. It's important. So that's light and shade. But back to the 3 G's. So G number one, graft. We can't underestimate just hours. There's a direct correlation, I think, between input and output. Second G, and I think this is sometimes the hardest, is grace. Grace under pressure.
Yes, very true.
Right? I haven't always found that easy. Mm-hmm. I think I've aged into that. Mm-hmm. I really believe that whilst I have my shit list, that you can't burn bridges. So grace under pressure, grace as a leader, you know, it's all about how you behave when things aren't going your way, because everybody can be brilliant when things are going your way. So the second G is grace, also my daughter's name. But the most important G is grit. You know, all of the data, and there's a famous book by Angela Duckworth called Grit. And to summarize it, which she wouldn't thank me for in like 3 sentences, all of the data shows that grit trumps genius every day of the week.
I agree.
Right? Mm-hmm. So you can be born, I'm fortunate, I have a good brain. Mm-hmm. My kids have good brains. One of them's pretty lazy, right? You know, and that's my message to him, is grit
Trump's genius. You have to learn how to dig deep. In every business that I've built, yes, there's the story, she sold it for 53 million or she, but there were the moments which we have all had when I couldn't pay the wages, when I had £1,000 left in the bank account. And I think the way that I frame it, if this is helpful for people listening, because I still have this all the time, and whether or not it's true, the framing helps. At the moment when you feel like giving up, that's the breakthrough.
Yeah.
So whether or not it is or it isn't, it becomes so, because that's what I tell myself.
The one question that I always ask our entrepreneurs is, and again, they all have very different answers. Sometimes, though, Debbie, a business is just not going to go. At what point does the grit have to stop, where you're throwing good money after bad? Or do you have the philosophy, I've started this business, I'm just going to keep going and going and going until I get it right?
Probably the latter.
You said, yeah.
Now, I like hard things. Right, I do. I like a challenge. I think you have to be open-minded enough to pivot. So I would say two things. One, you can't be so attached to the initial idea that you'll never shift it on. And you know, life happens. So if I look at Albright, which was the business that I co-founded, Members Clubs for Women here and in the US, a digital platform, went like an absolute rocket ship around the time of Trump won, where feminism was probably a different conversation, loads of private equity money attached to that. When COVID happened, our revenue was zero overnight. Zero, right? So if we hadn't decided that we needed to change up the way that business worked, we would have gone bust. I'm good in a crisis. I mean, someone once wrote, I think it was the Sunday Times once wrote a piece about Anna Jones, who was my Albright co-founder and I, and they said something like, they're the women that you'd want next to you in a sort of nuclear Armageddon, because they'd be, you know, coming out in designer dresses, figuring out how to solve everything. You know, we were a bit like that as a team. And I'm a big reader of fiction. Again, I'm a nerd. And there's a quote for me, Hilary Mantel, who's the greatest writer, a female writer of my lifetime, greatest writer of my lifetime, I think, who wrote the Wolf Hall trilogy. I like history as well. And one of my great historical heroes is Thomas Cromwell, the kind of arch politician, arch manipulator. And she has a great line in Wolf Hall where he, in his words, he says, and I've really held on to this, the things you think are disasters in your life are not disasters really.
No.
Almost never. Anything can be turned around. Out of every ditch, a path, if only you can see it. Mm-hmm. And for years, I did literally have out of every ditch, a path, if only you can see it, like, written on a poster on my laptop, because it's true. Yeah. But I am a bit, I've started to say I finished, Richard, but that doesn't mean that the business that finishes is the thing that I started with. But it does mean I'm very, 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 very determined.
There was a saying recently that Richard and I were using. I love it so much. The quality of your life is based on the quality of your thoughts. Mm. So if you're a solution-orientated person and you are relentless in your belief that everything has a solution, you will win.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm not sure it's even subconscious. I've been very conscious about that. You know, I very consciously have done a lot of therapy and a lot of work over the last 20 years to equip myself with the skills that I need to manage my mindset.
But do you not think, I mean, I've done shed loads of therapy too. Do you not think that some of it is just about survival, is actually about the instinctive understanding that it is pointless living this lifetime negative?
I think I'm fortunate in that I'm a sunny disposition, right? So yes. I think some people find the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune just harder to manage. But I also feel, if this is helpful, like, serious shit has happened to me, as it has to all of us. Mm. You know, things have not worked out the way I planned, of course. Mm-hmm. And I do this 24 hours, right? I give myself 24 hours to feel really sorry for myself, right? To scream into the pillow, to say, pull me, and then I'm done. Whatever it is, I'm done.
And
I'm
you
done.
Have a little word with yourself.
I do, and I
enough.
Say, right, we're done now.
That's fantastic.
We had 24 hours of feeling really... So I don't think it's realistic to say you can't feel it, because we're human.
Yeah.
But I am very structured in moving on. And yeah. I think that is a decision. Yeah.
Yes, I fully agree.
Life's about being the best you can be. Life's about fulfilling your potential. Life for me is about being in the arena.
Well, everybody yeah. says that they learn more from their failures than their successes. Am I right in saying out of the three businesses, yes. Debbie, that you've sold, HomeSwap was the big ticket one?
Yeah, I think that made my fortune.
53
for sure.
million.
It did, yeah.
Talk us through HomeSwap in a nutshell. Yeah. What was so special about that? Yeah. What did you hit and get right?
So the inspiration for the business... this is the PR story, but also the truth, which isn't always the case, but in this case it is. I was flying back from a holiday in the Caribbean when my kids were tiny, and I'd had that holiday that we've probably all had in some shape or form if we have had children, where, you know, it was rubbish. One was two, one was 3 months old. I'm like, why am I doing this? We were watching TV with the sound off, you know, trying to and deal with them on the plane. And I watched the film The Holiday, for those of you who have seen it. Yeah. And I thought, does that even exist? You know, that's what I wish I'd just done. I had a big house in London that I'd spent all the money for my first exit on. I wish I'd swapped it. But also a bit at that time, frankly, I wanted to swap my life. You know, I just didn't... Yeah. I wanted Fair Cameron enough. Diaz's Fair enough. Life. Yeah. I look great in LA. I'm like, and this is, you know, I'm not a small baby person, I think it's fair to say. And so that was the beginning of the whole thing. And then I became very obsessed with it, and I started looking around to see if anything existed, and the answer was, this is 2009-10, home exchange was a concept,
because it wasn't a financial transaction, was it?
It was a subscription, right. and that was the business model. So the sense was, you could become a member of a community that was full of people like us, right? So it was full of people who own nice homes and who potentially own second homes, and they would be very comfortable with exchanging homes with one another because it felt like a club.
Right.
Yeah.
Community's been quite a big theme through my career.
Yeah.
And it just hit that moment of the birth of Airbnb. So at the time when I started pitching for venture capital funding, which I did get in 2010-11, I was told by so many investors, nobody would ever stay in a stranger's home. So if you think about how we travel now, and, you know, it just wasn't what anybody did in 2010, right?
That's actually a good sign. That means you're onto something.
Exactly.
Can I ask you, Debbie, what something like that was obviously very internet-based.
Yes.
What was that money for?
So it's always, I think, for product, marketing and team, always, right? So you've got to build out the platform, and the, without being too technical, the unlocker for Love Home Swap was that we created what we called the three-way swap, right? So the quite easy thing to build is, I'm Paris and you're Milan, and we're going to swap homes with one another, right? That technically is quite easy. But actually, the real unlocker was to say, I'm Paris, you're Milan, but you want to go to Cape Town. So can you earn some points by allowing me to spend time in your home that you can then trade to go to somebody that's bankrupt? You see what I mean? So it became a currency and it became a genuine community. Technically, that's quite hard, right? So we needed money to build that out. We also needed a team. We also needed to market. You know what's so interesting now, both of you, because this has actually been really live for me in the last week. A few years ago, I was contacted by some American guys who were like, we were really inspired by Love Home Swap. We really love what you did and we want to start, go again. And the thing with me is, when I'm done with anything. I'm like, I can't even really bear to think or talk about it anymore. Good luck. Mm-hmm. This is a bit with the UK. So last week they announced that they'd raised $125 million in funding, which would just not happen here for a business that is Love Home Swap Mark II, right? So that to me was meaningful, because actually the trick, to come back to your question, Richard, around exit, is this, to boil it down. I talk about this a lot because there's a whole part of my life that's focused on getting more women starting businesses and getting more women funded, which we could perhaps talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the only thing that matters on the day of judgment when you sell is, how much of it do you own?
Anything,
right? It doesn't matter if you've gone and raised $125 million of macho money from some investors in the US, because they will then sit above you in terms of who gets paid out first. So the 53 million is a big number. There are other bigger exits. But at the end of the day, all that mattered is, as founder, I'd hung on to the equity. And I think we don't understand that well enough. Women founders definitely don't understand that well enough.
Why is that? Why do you think that is?
I think that there still aren't very many of us. So last year in the UK, 1.7% of venture capital invested went to back a female CEO. 1.7%. 88% of businesses that raise venture capital in the UK had no woman in the cap table, i.e. no woman holding any equity in the business. And on the other side of the table, at the highest level of investors in the UK, it's still 2% female. And yet a female investor is twice as likely to back a woman as a male investor. So part of what happens with female founders is, you may know some because you have great networks, but there still aren't very many of us. By the way, we deliver 35% better returns than men because we generally have to do more for
also
less.
Also better with money.
We just don't waste it.
That's an amazing stat.
It's totally true. And so in my world now where I chair the Investing Women Task Force for the government that's raised a £635 million funding pot to back more female investors with a mandate for them to back female entrepreneurs. It's part of the reason we're not growing in the UK, that entrepreneurship is so male.
We briefly touched on it with Lottie White.
Lottie.
Right, fabulous.
Yeah, she's great.
Lottie.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she was literally, I think she did 250 pitches and every single door was shut.
Yeah.
Also, because she's a person of colour as well and a woman, she was saying, I mean, the stats that she was rolling off about investment were absolutely shocking.
They're terrible. And so for women of colour, that 1.8% data is more like 0.8%.
Yeah, I believe
right on that. But actually, I think the pitch to the investment community has got nothing to do with gender. Like, this isn't a DE&I initiative. This isn't charity. This is an opportunity to find outsized returns. That's the way that we need to pitch it.
Do female entrepreneurs have to build their companies differently to men?
The answer to that question is nuanced. So have they had to? Yes. So there's a brilliant initiative called Super Scalers, which has done some work to identify female-owned businesses doing more than 50 million in turnover. That's the definition they've picked for scale. And when you look at that data, as I was doing the other week, the vast majority of them, 90% of those businesses, have scaled in a different way, right? So because they've had to. So they've bootstrapped their businesses, they haven't raised venture capital, they've gone to the bank, they've done it differently. But why should we have to? You know, it's very, very difficult.
Is this a European trait?
Let's be generous and say it isn't egregious sexism. Let's just take that as a point of view.
Do we have to?
For a second. Investors' job is to pattern match. That's their job. And so the fewer women you see, the fewer women you see. So to some extent, it just becomes completely self-perpetuating. And even my investors, I was backed in Love Homeswap by a fund called MMC Ventures, run by three men. And when I said to them, listen, I delivered you guys a brilliant return, why don't you back more women like me? And they said, we just don't see them, Debs, right? So I think in a way it becomes self-fulfilling. For me, that the shift, which is why the Investing Women Task Force, is you need more city capital, more institutional capital run by women.
But also, a lot of these men who are sitting there, they've never built a company.
No.
So you're dealing with men who don't even know what it is to build a company. They don't know the stress. They don't know the enormous pressure that's put on you. They don't know what it is like to drive and drive and drive for decades and to literally take no prisoners at times. To me, I see them as weak because I think, well, Christ, you're sitting there, you're saying whether or not you put money in a firm, and then you're sort of getting the returns, but you've never done it yourself. So
That's another UK-US thing. So another stat, I have all the stats, that's interesting, is 65% of investors in the US have been operators. In other words, they've been. In the UK, it's more like 5%.
Wow.
So I think I'm going to be generous to men just because I've learned the hard way that surrounding them in these conversations.
Don't worry, I'm sitting here taking it all on the chin, Debs. Don't worry.
But let us also say that I think the issue is potentially in the UK that you need more investors who have sat on the other side of the table. Actually, they make better investors.
You do.
What advice would you give a woman
yes.
or women
yes.
who are looking for investment. How yes. how do they get around this in yes. the UK? What's your yes. what's your little nutshell that you can give yeah. a little takeaway?
So I think part of what will happen now post my work with the government is there will be more female investors to pitch to, and there will be more female angel investors. So part of the issue, because there's no magic bullet to this thing, but one of the things that's also difficult and a bit to the why do I keep going and why can I keep going, because I know people with money. I'm also really good at asking men for money.
Are you?
Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a career. I certainly wouldn't have had a career in 2000.
But what is that?
I think I can speak fluent man. You know, I can. And it's I true. Think I can be, I'm good with them. And I think I can be very, very clear on pitching a business confidently that will deliver returns. I know my numbers backwards. Lottie's good on this as well, actually,
yeah.
about what you can do to change up the conversation and what you shouldn't do. This is a horrible generalization. It's hard to talk about this without generalizing. But often when I hear women pitching, and I hear that a lot because I invest also at Albright, we ran female founders pitch days, and I've been in this world for a long time, often, not always, they pitch for less money. They don't sell the dream in the same way as men do. So, you know, oh, for the confidence of a 26-year-old public school educated white guy who doesn't know what the hell he's doing. Like, you know, they come in, they pitch you the world. They pitch you the hockey stick. They pitch you the unicorn exit. They pitch you. Women tend to pitch what they know. They tend to pitch numbers that they feel comfortable with. So they need to, the way I feel when I go to the US, which I do a lot, I don't know if you agree, Roz, I tell myself when I'm getting off the plane, okay, you need to turn up the volume 50 to 75%.
Interesting.
Right, you cannot walk into this meeting and be charming and be self-effacing and be ironic and be, because they don't understand what the hell, right? You have to go in hard.
With passion, yeah.
And I think if you go in like that in the UK, and again, one of the complexities for women, which is a really difficult thing, is we need and want to be liked. It's not always possible to be liked. It's not always possible to be liked when you're building something. We have to accept that. But when you're pitching, you need to land it primarily with men. The US volume in the UK makes them feel, turns them off. Mm-hmm. So you have to adjust. And I think that does come with experience. You're selling, but you're not selling in the same way you sell when you get off the plane, because they think you're crazy. But getting the reading the room and getting the temperature right is important. And then the other thing is, raising friends and family finance is often really difficult for women because our networks are not as good as men's, mm-hmm. right? That was why we founded Albright, because there isn't a female version of a golf club. And it isn't always the case.
It's so true.
And also when we have our kids, no woman in the history of motherhood has ever thought, brilliant, I'm going to go to a networking event tonight. I don't know anyone. It's going to be a room full of men. Let's hope that there's some crappy canapes and warm wine. Off I go. I'm going to miss bath time. You just, so women's networks are very linear. I think there's a really interesting, Oprah Winfrey did an interview a few weeks ago around this new data point that shows that more women than ever are founding businesses post the age of 45. Right. And I think that's because we can. I think because we've dealt with those early childhood years, we know ourselves, we've got a better network. You know, the network that I had at 25 founding a business, frankly, and the reason I could show up in those rooms, which I never thought I'd be talking about age 52, is because I went to Oxford. And so when I'm talking to a lady of bankers, they're like, oh, she looks sort of cute and young, and you know, I was very young looking, 25. Oh, okay, she's clever. Like, that's all right. Well, maybe we'll take her a little bit. Oh, okay, yeah. She's been a management consultant. Okay. So, when I talk to other really successful female founders about their how, you're always having to layer on your badges to get heard, whatever your badges are.
I was the only woman in the Home Builders Federation every year. So there'll be like 1,000 men and Roz. And I believe the reason that I was able to move in those circles and I was a boss, was because I speak like this, I'm tall, and I had an American business partner.
Mm.
So the American business partner gave all his attitude towards business into me. So I learned a lot from that.
Now you've made some loot.
Yeah.
You're an investor yourself.
Yeah.
What are the key elements that you look for when you're looking to invest?
Yes. For the last probably decade, I've only put my personal money into backing women. I think it's really important that I put my money where my mouth is. This is stuff I talk about all the time. This is very, very obvious, but the thing that matters to me more than anything is the founder.
That's me out today, then.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't have invited you on if I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Love you.
Exactly. It's the founder, right? And so if I look, and I've backed a lot of young female founders, Grace Beverly, who's a Tala, and Hannah Chappet, who does Hyber, the student accommodation platform. It's arrogant to say I see myself in them, because that's not really what I mean. But I want to really get behind financially young women with chutzpah, with energy, with grit, and help them. So I invest where I can also help. Otherwise, I might as well give money to my AFA.
Is there a rule of thumb in terms of when you're investing? Do you need to feel you only need to own 25% of
it?
Oh, I see. How much money you... How much should they be putting in themselves? Yeah.
So this is the way I think about it. And this has probably been a journey of the last 3 years since I sold Albright, because I'm now in my portfolio era, trying to work out how I get that to work. And I had a few goes at it. So just angel investing for me, with love for the people that I back, is really boring. I'm an operator. And also you have to be careful. And there's no point spraying 25 grand here, there and everywhere, because what's the point, right? Yeah. So I did that for a bit. I don't do that anymore. This is how I think about it. I back myself and I back my team. So I would rather in my portfolio era put more of my money into something that I have a lot of ownership of, but where I'm not the CEO. And those are the two businesses that I chair, I have invested in, and I'm a significant shareholder in, and they are the Better Menopause and Fit, which is my AI business. What I stopped doing is small checks here, there, and everywhere. A, I couldn't really keep track of it. B, I just didn't own enough of it. So do I have rules? Sure, you know, I want to see what they're doing, and I want to see how in they are, and if I'm helping, I want my investment matched by additional equity. That isn't going to make me exponentially huge amounts of money. And that isn't really why I'm doing it. Nor is it charity work. If I'm doing charity work, I'm doing charity work. This, you know, why do I back these women? Because I think that they can deliver me at least a 10x return. Otherwise, forget it. I'm not even having the conversation. But I like, and I'm motivated by continuing to make money. For me, it shows a win. I like money under the bed. You know, luckily, I don't have a desire for a yacht or a plane or any of those kind of male toys. So it isn't about that. But it's about to being in the arena. So I've really organized my time to say I want to take fewer bigger bets. I don't want to be the CEO anymore because I'm tired. But I do want to chair businesses where I can partner with the CEO, deploy my capital and help them to scale something that I think is going to be big. Okay. So the final thing that I've done in the last few weeks, actually, is try and turn some of this into a course that is accessible for women. It's a paid course, but it's not going to kind of blow the budget. And it's called the WASCO method.
That's great.
And there's a lot in there about this sort of conversation, because everybody really wants to know the same things. How do you do it? Yeah. What's some simple stuff I can take away? Yeah. How do you raise money? How do you know if it's a good idea or a shit idea? It will be a cohort driven course that lasts 8 weeks that takes women through this process. So it's a paid course on a platform. On a Saturday morning, you get digital Debbie in your inbox, and there's a lot of work to do. You know, you've got to work through some of these exercises so that you can scope the work life that you want to have.
Well, they need that. That's exactly what they need. A lot of people are so afraid of making the leap. They have this concept that they don't want to lose their house. So how are they going to pay my rent? You know, what if I do this? What? I think one of the underpinning factors of an entrepreneur is you have to have a high risk propensity.
Yes.
You do need to be a person that will throw yourself off a cliff and figure it out 5 seconds before you hit the ground.
This stat on more women in their 40s and 50s getting going. What I would never tell anyone to do is to bet the farm. So my father said this to me when I was really young, never put a personal guarantee on anything.
Oh yeah.
Right. And I never have. Yeah. And I never, ever would. Yeah. Some women cock that one up, men too, but you know, so.
But serial entrepreneurs will do that though.
Not me. There's always a way to not do
is
that.
There?
Yeah, there is.
Well, you think they do, but actually they're just years of calculated risk.
I think that's
risk.
A mistake. I think there
we've had entrepreneurs here that were quite happy to bet it all on red.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is they've got a brain that has spent so many decades figuring out risk. They've done a very calculated risk and they know that they can make the leap.
But back to the how, because I was 25 and I'd sold it when I in my early 30s, I've never had to do that. But I couldn't have started Love Home Swap without having had an exit before I had my kids, because for years the cost of my childcare was greater than any money I earned from that business. I mean, that's the other thing about startup businesses that's the real. You won't earn any money for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, unless you founded a business that throws off cash. But the conventional venture capital angel funded business requires you to not earn very much as you go, yeah. Right? So you have to be really, really honest about whether you can do that. Yeah. And for women, I think the reason that they're starting later is they've done the kids, they've done the house, they've done it in different ways for different people. Yeah. So it feels de-risked. I don't think that means that they're not willing to take big swings around the business, but I think that taking big swings that put your livelihood at risk is something that not everybody's prepared to do, and nor do I think they need to. Just as I don't think you need to be Warren Buffett to invest, I don't think you need to have put everything on black in order to hit go. Right?
No, but you do need to pay attention to the person's spending habits, because some people just are spenders and other people are very good at needing nothing. Mentally, yeah. Just saying, I don't need anything. Yeah. And they can live like that a long time.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know, Richard has built his entire career around women. And I'm sitting here thinking, if there was one thing that you've learnt the most from dealing with women for, 30 years, what would you say you've learnt the most?
Think about that one carefully. No,
we
I can't possibly say that one.
Because he is so good with women.
Yes.
He's absolutely
incredible. But you know what I would say on that before you answer? Some of the most successful investors, there's a brilliant venture capital investor in London called Marcus Irie, who has a fund called Venrex. And he has backed all the mega female-led businesses, first in Charlotte Tilbury, first into everything.
Wow.
Very interesting. And when you say to him, why did you do it? Men don't do that. Why did you do it, right? Yeah. And number one, he says, because I understand women. And number two, he says, thanks very much to all the guys like the ones that you encountered who won't touch it. Gives me the opportunity to find alpha. Thanks very much.
It feels like a difficult road through your business career with men. Now you've achieved so much. How are men to you now?
I think I've earned my place in the room.
Absolutely.
With many, but probably not all.
No, never all. It just will
I just
not
don't
be
think
possible.
It can be. And I also think, this is my grandmother, and I was talking about this very morning, the higher you climb, the harder the wind blows. And I think this is the other thing about happiness. There's always going to be somebody with a bigger boat. You know, there's always going to be somebody out there that's done more, that's done better, that thinks that exit was too small, that thinks you have to be happy with your lot and recognize that as a woman, no matter the badges, no matter the only woman in the House Building Association, the American business partner, and there are always going to be men where you emerge and they think, what's she doing here? And that's okay, because you can't win them all. I always do the work, and therefore I'm confident in my perspective. I always have the data. So I think I don't shy away from having difficult conversations with anyone, but I don't shy away from having difficult conversations.
But also, you've got a lovely feminine energy about you too. You've got a lovely dress on. You're very pretty. You've got your hair all down. You've got a real feminine sense, which is lovely. You've held on.
Yes. I'm sure they find that very confusing. But yes, that's right.
I should imagine from your point of view, that must be lovely to stand back now and just watch that sort of unfold. On that note about femininity, for want of a better word, I was going to say you're really big into menopause courses.
Yes, I'm big into menopause.
I know you're
not. It's fine.
Is it a business that you've set up?
It's a business,
Talk us through that.
Yes. So again, I'm a very simple founder in lots of ways, because every business I've found, probably a different one for every decade, has I've connected with it because of something that's happening in my life. You have far more sophisticated founders than me, but for me, that's kind of the way it works. I see a thing and then I'm kind of obsessed with the thing. Wow. And what happened to
me,
I'm 52 now. When I was 48, I got super sick. and I don't love the term burnout because I think it's very kind of overused, but that's probably
what burnout like five times in my life.
Yeah. So I ended up with pneumonia and pleurisy and I was super ill in hospital and felt horrible. And when I got better and I've been on a lot of antibiotics for a long time, I just didn't feel like myself. Like normally I'm very good at putting the uniform on, you know, and then I just didn't really feel like that. And I saw tons of doctors. And there was a moment in a conversation with the doctor where he said, "You're in perimenopause," which I found very insulting. It's like, what do you mean? You know, this is 4 years ago. And then we need to remember that that whole conversation around menopause 4 years ago was just not fully formed. Anyway, I'd never heard of perimenopause. I'm like, what the hell's that? You know, and part of the reason that you're really struggling with all of these different symptoms is that your gut health is totally compromised because you've been on antibiotics for so long. There's an inextricable connection between menopause and the microbiome.
Yes.
And I'm like, is there?
I studied that once.
Like, what? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I've been on Simpri for years. I eat sauerkraut. Jesus Christ. What more can a woman do, you know? And he's like, it won't do anything. And then I became obsessed with, okay. And then I kind of went very deep and I found the big menopause doctor in the UK, Shazadi Harper, and I found the biggest supplements manufacturer in the UK who then invested in the business and a clinical nutritionist. And we developed this business called the Better Menopause. And the hero product is the first probiotic for women in peri and menopause that's been formulated and is in clinical trial to really target this change. And it sits alongside whether or not you're on HRT. Most 50% of women who can are now in the UK, 5% in America. It's a really interesting kind of global story.
So you're not saying, do this, throw away the HRT.
No way. I'm on anything I can possibly get. So I take absolutely everything, all of our products, anything. So absolutely not. But there's a whole constituency of women who can't take HRT because they've had cancer, and there are women who choose not to and all the rest of it. It's called the Better Menopause. The hero product's called Better Gut, and we have three other products. Better Night, which is a sleep product. Again, this is totally selfish. This is things that I needed because my sleep's awful. But I had a melatonin habit for years that I had to pick up in the US, and it was starting to make me feel crap. So we have a really efficacious sleep product that's got cherry extract and very high quality magnesium and a load of different ingredients. And then we have a metabolism product. So that's in clinical trial at University of Southampton at the moment called Better Metabolism, because not everybody should be on a GLP-1 and a lot of people I know are on GLP-1s and it's an alternative. And then the final product is called Better Libido. I wanted to build a business that had a positive impact on women's life in midlife.
We've got a menopause clinic in the salon now. It seems okay to talk about the menopause, and that feels to me like it's only been in the last 5 or 10 years.
For many women, finding solutions and feeling like they found a solution to how they feel will make them therefore feel better. And the stats are, by the way, 25% of women say they want to leave the workforce during menopause, 10% actually do. I would like that to be 0%, because to come back to my why, I think that women and work is one of the greatest sources of joy in women's lives. And I think that many women find it hard to stay in because of their fertility journey. So you have people that drop out at the baby stage and don't come back. I don't want women dropping out in their 50s because they feel like they're not managing their symptoms. Yeah. I think people present in really different ways. And I have had people who are friends of mine who've sailed through it and not noticed anything. I've had people that really started struggling in their early 40s. Do I think that mindset is everything? Well, I kind of think that mindset's everything in life.
Yeah.
But I also think that it is really the case that different women need different support in different ways. What I would say in terms of the Better Menopause business is I had not understood how the gut was the source of everything in women's health.
Wow, what a wonderful chat
has been. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Last question, you're on death row, Debbie.
Yes.
You've been very naughty girl.
Okay, goodness, that's scary.
But you are allowed to have your last meal.
Oh God, I hate this question. What is it? Such a crappy
eater. The men love this meal.
Yeah, I know. And I've been asked this before and I say something a bit pathetic like sushi.
Just double up on your supplements.
Exactly. I think you live to eat or you eat to live, don't you? And I definitely eat to live.
Okay, what's the last book you're allowed to read?
Oh, probably a Barbara Kingsolver, either Demon Copperhead or The Poisonwood Chronicles. Sorry, I'm a books nerd, but something like that. But the best book I've read recently, because I do work with the Women's Prize for Fiction, I've done that for years, which is the biggest prize for women's fiction in the world. And by the way, the gender pay gap in fiction is 35%, so we need to make sure women authors earn, is a fantastic book called The Correspondent by Virginia Evans. So that's my hot off the press tip for a read now.
We've had some impressive women on this show.
You are on fire.
You are right up there with the very, very best. I mean, we're both entrepreneurs, but sitting talking to you, we feel like we've sort of achieved very little.
Don't say that.
We just know that in a nicest possible way. It's a compliment to you. And you've been so candid as well. And we're very, very hugely grateful for you coming on the show. Thank you so much, Debbie Wasko, for coming on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. If you've liked it, hit the subscribe button and maybe give us a like. We'd really appreciate it.
And thank you, Trip, for the beautiful cans. It tastes delicious.
Thank you.
Can you do us a favour? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.